Welcome everybody to another episode of Real Life Theology, and I am once again joined by Kenny Pierce. And Kenny, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, so this is round two. I wanted to start us off again, this time talking just about sort of the state of play with, you sort of have two sides. There's like the Christian apologetics, and then there's sort of what I think of as the theistic philosophers, maybe. And there's not always like a hard distinction to be drawn between those two things. But I did want to get your perspective as far as, like, would you say there is some kind of a distinction, even if it's fuzzy, between Christian apologetics and Christian philosophers of religion? And if so, what do you think distinguishes those two things, like in terms of maybe methods or the qualities of them, or just get your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think there's a distinction, at least between those two activities, philosophy and apologetics. And so the same people do both sometimes at the same time. And the distinction, I think, is this, that philosophy is an activity of research or inquiry.
Yeah.
Right. And so philosophy is trying to figure out the right answers, or at least better answers, to difficult questions, and figure out the best versions of arguments and things like that. You know, apologetics is the defense of the faith, is kind of what that term means. And what that means is, you know, if you're no longer endorsing the kind of principles that you were supposed to be defending, then you're not doing that apologetics anymore. And so from that perspective, it's not really about trying to change your own mind about things to get better beliefs for yourself. At the same time, if you do believe that there are good reasons for endorsing this faith, good reasons for being a Christian, well, then you might think that apologetics is engaged in some kind of public education, right? That there really are these reasons and you're trying to help the public or a wider audience understand those reasons. And those reasons are likely to come from philosophy. And so, so good apologetics could be a kind of public philosophy or philosophy education, right? That is aiming to teach people about the good reasons that there are for being a Christian, or something like that. I tend to get a little skeptical, both because a lot of what goes under the name apologetics is not good, which isn't to say that all of the philosophy is good, you know, but
fair enough,
but.
Yeah.
But a lot of the stuff that goes under that name is not good.
Yeah.
But also because I tend to think that that focus on defense, it's often not very good as an education strategy for kind of trying to really understand and appreciate the reasons. And it also can do this bad thing where it's like all about trying to hold on to what we believe to begin with. And as a philosophy professor, I think that's a terrible way of learning philosophy. But also as a Christian, I think that's inimical to growth and maturity in the faith. That I think if you really want to grow and mature, you have to be thinking about, obviously belief is only a tiny part of being a Christian and growing as a Christian. But for that part that is about belief, just like for all the other parts, you want to be changed over time as you grow and mature in the faith. And that is scary and uncomfortable for a lot of people whose faith really means a lot to them. And I think it's good for people's faith to mean a lot to them. But I also think that you kind of have to approach these questions and approach these inquiries as someone who loves truth. And so the goal isn't to figure out how to hold on to what you've believed all along. The goal is to have true beliefs, recognizing that what you've believed all along is probably a mixture of truth and falsity.
So I feel like a lot of, a lot of apologists sort of conflate two senses of that idea of doing apologetics. So there's sort of like the, because what they'll bring out is sort of the etymology of the word, you know, it's like, it's giving a defense. And that's fair, you know, so if you're defending something, in some sense, you're doing apologetics. But I don't feel like that word means the same thing today, really. Like, there seems to me there's a difference between being a professional apologist and doing apologetics sort of by accident, if you will, you know, like, because you happen to be defending a view. You know, so philosophers will defend views, obviously, if they think they're correct, kind of like what you were saying. But I wouldn't necessarily call them apologists just because they happen to be defending a view. It seems like more, at least these days, apologetics has taken on more of a, like, if you are an apologist, you've sort of like, this is my conclusion, and now it's my job to defend it.
Yeah,
that's accurate.
Yeah, well, and I think there are problems about incentive structures, you know, for when it's literally your job.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that doesn't only happen to apologists and clergy and so forth. There are professors, including philosophy professors, who are employed at colleges and universities that have a statement of faith. That, like, if they openly departed from that statement of faith, their position and their livelihood might be threatened.
Interesting.
And of course, in the past, and in some countries still today, but in the past, in nearly all countries, you know, there were times where there were these kinds of limits on free and open speech that about religion specifically, right? It's still limited in many countries today, but in the past, nearly everywhere. That again would have created those incentives that it's just like easier for you if you can believe the thing that you're allowed to believe.
Right.
And everyone faces social pressures and things like that to believe and endorse the right things that their peer group likes. But when you add kind of financial and legal incentives, then we've got kind of a whole new level where it is just, it just becomes harder to be that kind of sincere inquirer after truth, which is a hard thing to begin with.
And there's kind of on both, obviously there's sort of apologists on both sides. I guess on the theistic side, you have like people who will identify as apologists. On the non-theistic side, or maybe the even strictly atheist side, you have sort of, they're more referred to as like new atheists or maybe internet atheists who tend to behave very similarly. And a lot of, you know, criticism of the new atheists was that, you know, they had some legit reactions to some of the things that were going on, but a lot of the criticism focuses on, well, they don't take sophisticated theism very seriously, and they should. And on the other side, maybe apologists, you know, they kind of have their spiel and they don't seem to take sophisticated atheism very seriously. Do you have any recommendations on how we could maybe help get both sides, you know, to take the other sophisticated sides more seriously rather than sort of getting into their little myopic focus, you know, on the goofy aspects, you know, of the other side?
Yeah, I mean, it's odd and it's difficult that those people on both sides there can be so adamant about what the other side does or must believe, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And you folks, you the Real Atheology group are out there on Twitter saying, hey, I'm an atheist and I don't believe that.
Yeah.
Right? And apologists will just double down on like all atheists do and must believe moral error theory or something, right?
Yeah.
Well, some atheists believe that, sure.
Sure, yeah.
But not all of them, and they don't have to.
Right.
Or evolutionary ethics, and then they're usually using some awful caricature of evolutionary ethics to do this parade of horribles thing. Well, evolutionary ethics has problems, but not all of those problems necessarily. Right, or there are ways of trying to address them.
Sure.
And so a lot of it is just listening, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is just listening, that we have to let our opponents or our dialogue partners define their own position and talk to a particular person as a particular set of beliefs, you know? And it would make a big difference even if apologists would just say many atheists,
right,
instead of atheists, right?
Yeah.
Many Christians and so on.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think philosophers need to pay more attention to than they do, and that needs more serious reflection, is that religion and non-religion are ways of life. And they're crucially important to people practically and socially and emotionally. And I do not think those things should be ignored in these debates and discussions. You know, that if you really want to understand, especially an ordinary person who's a person who's not a professional philosopher or theologian, mm-hmm. what is the content of their religion? Well, if they're an evangelical, for instance, they're likely to say a lot about their beliefs when they're asked that. But even people who are inclined to explain themselves that way, that's really not the whole story of what their religion is and why they're committed to it. There's a lot more going on about, you know, why this is so important to them, why it makes a difference in their lives, and why the idea of kind of abandoning it or feeling like it's under attack might be emotionally difficult. And these people who are on the side of non-religion or of atheism, you know, there is something similar going on. And it's easy for both sides to caricature each other about that. Oh, God is just a crutch because you can't get through the world on your own, or you're an atheist, you're just angry about God, or these are silly caricatures.
Right.
Right. But when you look at it, the like many, not all, but many non-religious people have people who are I should say anti-religious people, right? People where for whom it's not a mere lack of religion, but who are opposed to it. Mm-hmm. For many of them, they feel very strongly that the forms of religiosity that they're most familiar with are a force for evil in the world. Mm-hmm. And that feeling may be based on their personal experience. Mm-hmm. Some of these people have even experienced severe forms of abuse. Yeah. Or they may have a praiseworthy sensibility or sensitivity to the kinds of severe evils in the world that have been connected with religion. Despite, and again, it's praiseworthy to have a kind of sensitivity to or investment with that, even if you haven't been affected personally. Mm. To have that kind of sympathy with others that would say, you know, I can't accept the awful things that have happened to people because of the forms of religiosity that are familiar to me.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's a mistake to caricature that, and it's a mistake to use those as ways of dismissing people's kind of rational argumentation. But it also, if we're talking about religion and not just the abstract philosophical proposition God exists under some definition of God, that is actually what it's about, is this question of whether belonging to a community that has these beliefs and practices and takes these attitudes to one another and to God is a way of promoting human flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
And people are right, particularly if they're not philosophers who are trying to develop fundamental theories to explain why all this is true. People are right to judge based on their experience.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't overgeneralize, right? And think that kind of all religion is like the form that they're most familiar with, or that kind of all non-religion is like the form they're most familiar with, or that anybody without religion, you know, because religion makes such a big difference to my ability to kind of love my neighbor or whatever. Therefore, everyone who doesn't have that doesn't love their neighbor. Right. So people should be careful about avoiding overgeneralization, but I also think we shouldn't ignore the lived aspect of religion and non-religion in these discussions.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, this leads nicely into the next thing, because we mentioned already kind of what you brought up, kind of the moral argument as a good example of how sometimes, you know, you can pigeonhole all atheists into, or all atheists can be sort of pigeonholed into believing one, you know, you have to believe this about morality. And that seems to be actually, from what I've seen, and maybe you can either confirm or deny this, but from what I've seen, that seems to be a very common argument against atheists, even from lay people, but also from, I don't know, I would say maybe probably more on the apologist side, not necessarily theistic philosophers in general, but more from those apologists, is like the moral argument and saying, well, atheists can't consistently uphold, say, objective morality. And you've kind of spoken out against this, I know. And so maybe you could explain, and hopefully, you know, people can understand this a little bit better. You know, why does that argument fail, you know, to just say that atheists can't subscribe to objective morality?
So since we're talking about the discussion in the popular context,
right,
let me say the most important thing first.
Yeah.
Whether you have a satisfactory theory of morality and its foundation is a completely different question from whether you are a moral person.
Right.
And there are people intentionally conflating that in these popular debates.
Yeah.
Whose goal, and according to my understanding of biblical morality, those people are not behaving very morally, right? They're the people who are making that conflation intentionally.
Sure.
And just kind of insulting and attacking others in this way. So the question that is at issue is about whether you can provide a satisfactory theory of the foundations of morality that's going to get the right kind of objectivity.
Right.
Now, what's the right kind of objectivity? Well, at least individuals and whole cultures can be wrong about it. So, like, whether it's a single individual or an entire culture who thinks that slavery is fine, those people are wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's, to me, that's the kind of objectivity that matters. Individuals, whole cultures could be wrong about it. People sometimes try to ramp up what they mean by objectivity further and further, so that kind of only one view will do the trick.
Yeah.
But the thing is, first, metaethics, the question of the foundations of morality, is not easy for theists. Right, so believing in God doesn't just instantaneously solve the problem. When you look at theistic theories, both the traditional ones and kind of in the contemporary context, there are a lot of different ways those go, but they're quite complex, right? So there are these sophisticated theories. Simplistic theories like it's right because God commands it are just non-starters. They're in no way objective. It's like all humans could be wrong about it, of course.
Right.
But it's just some other person just making stuff up.
Right.
Right. And that's not a good way of thinking about either God or morality, like slavery is bad or torture is bad or whatever. It's just something God arbitrarily made up. That's right. No good.
Right.
And so we need something that's going to, you know, give us something stronger about objectivity and necessity and non-arbitrariness. And so it's just that this is a difficult question for both theists and atheists is what I want to say.
Yeah.
And in order for the moral argument to work, it would need to be shown that there is an adequate solution to the problem. The only adequate solution to the problem is a theistic one.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, nobody's come remotely close to showing that. And if you were going to make that argument, if you were going to make kind of a plausible version of the moral argument, what the plausible version would do is it would be some kind of theory choice approach, right? Where you would say, oh, we've got all these different theories of the foundations of ethics, and the best one or the best ones make appeal to God, right? And so having God somewhere in our worldview is kind of an advantage for theory construction.
Hmm.
But it just isn't true that there are no atheistic theories of object morality.
Right.
And it certainly isn't obvious that the atheistic theories are, you know, more problematic or less plausible than the theistic ones. It's just that we have to do some really hard philosophy if we want to talk about this question. And so these like apologetic gotchas are just not getting anywhere.
Yeah. Would you say that you, I mean, obviously you're a theist, so you of course think God factors into that in the correct view, but are there any secular theories or atheistic theories of morality that you find most interesting or plausible? Like, you know, if you were to be an atheist and hold on to objective morality, are there any theories that you would say, yeah, I'd probably hold to that one?
Well, so I'm a Kantian about the foundations of ethics. Mm-hmm. And Kant himself thought that God was important to the theory, but not in the way that the popular apologists think God is important.
Gotcha.
And I also think that the kind of Kantian theory, you know, works better with God than without.
Mm-hmm, sure.
In certain ways, but it's not that it doesn't work at all without. And I'd say the same thing about various other theories that kind of, like if you're looking at Aristotelian virtue ethics, there may be ways in which God fits into the theory nicely, right? But clearly there are atheistic versions of Aristotelian virtue ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, if you have some kind of Platonism, there might be advantages to putting the Platonic objects in the divine mind rather than having them independently subsisting out of any mind. But clearly there are atheistic versions of the Platonic approach.
Mm. Yeah.
So I've thrown out some kind of philosophy jargon there and haven't tried to explain these theories in detail, but that's just to say the kind of, I think the best theistic theories have atheistic variants.
Gotcha.
And yeah, maybe the theistic version variants are a little better than the atheistic ones, but like if one secures objective morality, the other one does too.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
that's fair. It's obviously one of the key arguments on the atheistic side is the problem of evil. Mm-hmm. And some apologists, like say Frank Turek, for instance, think that the problem of evil actually proves God's existence. What do you make of that? And you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. it's pretty goofy, right?
Yeah.
So there is this talk about the atheistic problem of evil.
Yeah.
And some versions of that look like they're pretty much the same as the moral argument.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's something people are trying to say, like, you wouldn't be worried about this problem unless you recognize that there were objective evils in the world, but your worldview doesn't allow that or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it depends on what you're doing with that argument, right? So there's multiple problems with this approach. One is that the problem of evil could be presented just as an internal problem for theism, right? Because mm-hmm. theists, as these apologists keep reminding us, believe in objective good and evil. And evil, right? That is, they believe there's evil in the world.
Yeah.
And so you could just run the argument as like, look, your view of the world predicts that, these claims about God predict that there wouldn't be any evil in the world, but you yourself admit that there is, but it's part of your own worldview that there is. So you've got a problem. you could just lay out the problem and stop there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, you could have an atheistic theory that allows for objective evil.
Right.
You could just think like, you could have a purely subjective view and still run the problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that there are good reasons based on the conception of God for thinking that God would care about those things.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you're arguing against Christianity, and as a philosopher, I always want my views to be subjected to the best counter arguments, right? Because that's how I learn from them.
Right.
If you're arguing against Christianity, well, Christianity says that God loves and cares for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would sure seem to imply that God doesn't want us to suffer.
Right.
So even if you don't think that there is such a thing as objective evil because you're like a moral error theorist or something, you could still think the fact that there's human suffering in the world is evidence against the claim that there's a God who loves and cares for humans.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This ties the idea of evil and all this and the morality thing ties also into sort of questions of meaning. And it seems that one of the other things that apologists will tend to try to press atheists on is, you know, the ability to have meaning. Do you think it's possible for atheists to have objective meaning in the world, especially in light of, you know, it's usually brought up, well, there's the probable future heat death of the universe, and so everything's going to come to naught anyway. So how can an atheist have any objective meaning? What are your thoughts on that?
There's this old joke about an analytic philosopher being assigned to teach a class called The Meaning of Life.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out to be a biology class on the meaning of life, the word, you know, right? A philosophy biology class.
Yeah.
Because a lot of us analytic philosophers feel like we're not really sure what people are talking about when they ask about the meaning of life.
Yeah.
And you know, people give that as a definition of philosophy. Oh, it contemplates the meaning of life. Uh-huh. No. I do think this, look, if you're... I think both theists and atheists should be Kantians about the foundations of ethics. And if you believe that Kantian theory, it implies that you are an end in yourself, that you have this objective value that both you and others are obligated to value you as an end in yourself.
Hmm.
Is that what people want when they want the meaning of life? For mm-hmm. You to be valuable, so that both you and others have an obligation to value your humanity and your life on Earth. That seems pretty good. I also think there's no reason atheists can't have projects and hopes and aims that they care about and are committed to and try to accomplish in the world to do more good than evil, you know? And so maybe that's what people mean by the meaning of life. So insofar as I can make sense of the question,
mm-hmm.
I do understand personally how a religious commitment to the life with God and the idea of relationship with God in the context of a religious community and so on. I do in a personal way understand how that might make your life more meaningful or might give meaning to your life.
Sure.
And so this is another place where I'm inclined to think as a Christian theist, I'm inclined to think that Christian theism does better than the alternatives.
Sure.
But I don't think the alternatives get you nothing at all. Right. As though atheists have kind of no reason to go on. I think there's all kinds of reason to go on. even within that view, because a human being is an end in itself.
Let's switch gears here just a little bit then, and because another big thing these days is like design arguments. What are your thoughts on design arguments? Do you think that they're particularly good, or are they not as persuasive to you as some other people find them to be?
Well, certainly they're not as persuasive as some apologists try to present them as being, but you know, some people have this habit of acting like everything is some kind of knockdown end of the story kind of approach, right?
Yeah.
I don't think sophisticated design arguments add that much to simple ones.
Mm.
I think simple design arguments are provide a rational basis for belief. I don't think they're a kind of knockdown proof, but I think they can provide a rational basis for belief. And so I'm thinking of arguments like things in nature are observed to have purposes. Eyes mm-hmm. are for seeing.
Mm-hmm.
There can be no purpose without someone whose purposes there are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's someone who intends eyes for seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, evolutionary theory can be interpreted as undermining either of those premises, or it can be interpreted as consistent with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you might interpret it as showing that that this kind of purposiveness, the idea that eyes are foreseeing, is an illusion. I think that's a mistake. Biologists talk about function all the time, and mm-hmm. function just is purpose.
Mm.
And so I think that kind of radical approach is not actually making good sense in the philosophy of biology.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think atheists should reject that second premise. I think atheists should think that that evolutionary theory shows how we can get purposes without there being an agent whose purposes they are. Yeah. By these kind of evolutionary processes.
That seems to be Dan Dennett's approach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the theist could also think, no, we've got a more robust form of purposiveness than that, that, you know, that we want to preserve and could hold on to that premise while endorsing evolutionary theory.
Hmm.
I'm not much of a fan of fine-tuning arguments, and here I'm a way outlier. I'm a small minority of the philosophy of religion community here. even most atheists in philosophy of religion think that the fine-tuning argument is the most respectable of the theistic arguments, right? Mm. Even those who disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not such a fan myself, because I think it's part of the methodology or approach of theoretical cosmology.
Mm.
To try to reduce or eliminate those fine tunings.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Things are considered, at least by many cosmologists, not to be adequately explained mm-hmm. if the theory needs a fine tuning in order to entail them. Mm. And so I think the fine tuning argument is basically equivalent to a God of the gaps argument in the sense that it's just pointing to something that science hasn't yet explained.
Sure.
But science has a long track record of succeeding at explaining things eventually, and there's kind of no in principle reason why we shouldn't hope for cosmology to eventually eliminate those fine tunings.
Now, there's a lot of current work in popular apologetics that was a reaction to kind of going back to the, you know, on both sides we've got the new atheists and then we've got kind of like the self-identified apologists on the other side, and it seems like the apologists tend to focus on reacting to the new atheists. There's been like a lot of work done on responding to new atheists. Do you think we'll see a lot more response to popular apologetics from sophisticated atheism? You know, kind of, do you think there's going to swing back the other way and we're going to see a lot more response to popular apologetics, or do you think it'll just kind of be ignored or stay in those separate fields?
I can't make much of a prediction, I guess, but let me express a hope.
Yeah.
We are at a time when a lot of universities and a lot of people in the academy are focused more on what we're now calling public scholarship.
Mm.
That is on actual academics making their work accessible to a broader audience and bringing this stuff to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is crucially important for disciplines like philosophy, where there's a large segment of the public that doesn't really have accurate ideas about what it even is, that maybe thinks it's useless.
Yeah.
And here, you know, wearing my hat as a head of a department of philosophy and religion in a public university.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking our disciplines, philosophy and the academic non-confessional study of religion, right, as a secular academic enterprise, those are both subject to a lot of misconceptions, including the idea that they're useless and irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And we're funded by taxpayer and tuition dollars here.
Yeah.
And so I think we have both a moral obligation and a practical imperative to try to not to confine ourselves to the ivory tower. And I don't mean every single philosophy professor, because not everyone's good at it, right?
Right.
but we need as a group, as a collective philosophy professors, to make that effort and reward that work to show the relevance and the benefit of our discipline to a broader audience.
Yeah.
And so what I would hope to see is that both theists and atheists, and even philosophers who are not working within that debate, but philosophy in general, becoming more accessible to a broader audience, rather than ceding that space entirely to the popular apologists and anti-apologists.
Yeah.
And I would hope that, you know, I don't mean by this to exclude the people who aren't academics from the conversation.
Right.
But rather to say that, like, I hope that the academics will become part of the conversation and that the conversation will improve as a result.
Yeah. It seems to me that there's a bit more productivity when you have the academics kind of engaging. Not that it's always productive, but it seems like there's a bit more charity and it's a bit more like a collaborative, which we'll talk about in a little bit with your exchange with Graham Oppie, I felt like was a good example. And Josh Rasmussen and Felipe Leon had another good one in book form. Whereas like on the strictly, you know, the apologetic side and maybe the new atheist side, you know, there seems to be a lot more heat there.
Right.
It's a lot more combative. Which is unfortunate. So I agree that it would be nice to have that sort of example set a little bit more of like, we're on the same side here. We're all just in this world trying to figure it out. And we're really, you know, we're fellow humans, you know, trying to figure things out. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here, go ahead. What were you going to say? Something?
Oh, just, I think it's the fellow humans trying to figure things out is a very good way of putting it.
Hmm.
And especially, you know, if you think that if you're thinking of the people you're talking to as seekers, right? Or even the audience of the debate, right? Mm-hmm. As people, and by seekers, I just mean people who care about religious questions and don't think they already know all the answers.
Right.
Which doesn't mean you're neutral between religions or between Christianity and atheism, right? You might be in one, but still kind of not think you know all the answers and you're out there looking still.
Yeah.
Which I think is where we all should be.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about that and you're thinking that you're trying to help them along the way, right, then I think you would it just would look really different than trying to score points and win debates, right? That's just a different enterprise.
Well, what do you think of actually the whole format of, you know, speaking of debates, you know, there's a lot of debates that happen, and I get that there's utility and value in or can be in debates, but I find that I appreciate discussions more than like formal debates. I don't know. What are your thoughts on the utility of those?
Yeah, I was actually hesitant to accept the invitation to do the debate book. I was, the editor was kind of asking different people for each side at the same time, right? So, Graham wasn't confirmed yet at the time that I got the invitation.
Gotcha.
And I was a bit hesitant to do that at first, just because I don't think I'm much of a debater. I mean, I spend much too much time saying what I think are the best arguments against my position, right? Like I'm all the time like, well, here are the problems that I'm working on, right? Yeah. How I'm working through them. I hope in the end that the debate format turned out to be an effective way of making sure that each side got a fair and sympathetic presentation, and that we could put kind of both of these perspectives into one book and interaction with each other in a productive way. Mm-hmm. I think there's a way in which that book isn't much of a debate, in the sense that as much as we're kind of trying to participate in that format, we're also just philosophizing together. And it's not, although we're on different sides of a very important question, it's not enormously adversarial.
Right.
So I think the format can be useful for making sure that we're giving a full hearing to both views. I guess what I think can be counterproductive about the debate format is the focus on winning.
A lot of like, you know, especially in person, on the stage, formal debate styles like that can definitely set up the my team versus your team sort of mindset. And then everybody already picks a side, you know, and they just want to see the other guy get trounced, you know.
Right.
It's almost like a sporting event in some sense, where you're just there to see your side win, unfortunately. And again, that's not to say that those aren't beneficial in some way, you know, because you're laying out a position, and that, you know, gets that information out there, and you kind of see two worldviews collide. So it can be good. But again, I like the more collaborative approach, which I thought you and Graham did a very good job with. So I guess a good follow-up question for you then, based on what you were just talking about, would be that fairly recently, I guess, because I know you spend a little bit of time on Twitter, which, you know, it's good that it's good to not spend too much time on Twitter. But you talked about, maybe you remember this not too long ago. I can't remember exactly how long ago it was, but you had mentioned that it's okay to not have 100% certainty in your beliefs, which you kind of were just speaking about here. And you received a little bit of pushback for that. And I wonder if you could maybe just, you know, build on your thoughts about that and maybe elaborate on your perspective as to why it's okay, you know, even as a believer, where a lot of people think maybe, you know, or they get uncomfortable, you know, like if I say I'm not sure, that somehow is a deficiency, but you seem to think, no, it's okay, you know, to not necessarily be absolutely certain.
I think some of the pushback that I received was based on some miscommunication about what we would mean by certainty in analytic philosophy compared to what people might mean in other contexts.
Yeah.
And also, I think there may be some confusion about certain historical conceptions of faith that are using these concepts, this notion of certainty or notions translated as certainty in rather different ways. So, you know, what I mean by certainty is like when I reflect on the reasons for my belief, on like why I believe what I do, I recognize that kind of everything could seem just the way it does to me and I could still be wrong, right? That as far as I can see, like I can't, like the from my subjective point of view, right? I just can see when I step back and reflect that I could easily have gotten this wrong. And that I'm thinking, honestly, I think people who can't recognize that about their beliefs about God and religion and whatnot, that they could have gotten it wrong, are, I mean, that's, I'm sorry, it's either terribly unreflective or it's delusional.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I could be wrong. I think, you know, it's just an unavoidable part of the human condition.
Yeah.
That there are these enormously momentous things that we build our lives around and we take actions based on that we could get wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
In terms of the pushback that I was getting, you know, some people I think have can't dissociate what my notion of lack of certainty from what Bible translations sometimes call wavering or being double-minded, especially I'm thinking of a passage in James. That's talking about a kind of instability in your beliefs, particularly insofar as they motivate your actions, right? But you can be totally stably committed and living your life on the basis of something while recognizing intellectually that it's possible for you to be wrong.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's kind of how I think about faith.
Okay.
Right. As like, this is bedrock to my approach to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it's not provable the way math is. Right.
Sure.
It's like, it is, there is room for error here.
Yeah.
But I gotta do something.
Yeah.
Right. And so in a way it's bedrock. It's firm in the sense of its practicality and my commitment to it.
Yeah.
But the possibility that I've gotten everything wrong, is unavoidable.
Yeah.
Another kind of confusion that I think leads to some pushback is that some historical philosophers, and I think still some Thomists today, have a notion of objective certainty that is not about kind of my subjective state or what I can prove or what I have epistemic access to. It's about how these truths or claims are actually grounded, right? And so the idea is, like, if it's really told to me by God, or if I'm right in taking this as revelation from God, and God can't lie, and it's metaphysically impossible for God to lie or be mistaken, well, then the matter is objectively certain. Right. That is, the way in which it's grounded by that kind of divine testimony and whatever is sufficient to guarantee its accuracy. Right. If you're a physicalist, you might think that that there's a similar kind of objective certainty in the claim that I have a brain. Right, because it's like metaphysically impossible that I have, on certain physicalist views, that I have that belief and it's false. Like, the way I get that belief guarantees its truth.
Gotcha.
But that's not subjectively for me, right? Like, I could be in a, could I be in a computer simulation and not have a brain or something?
Yeah.
Well, subjectively, I can recognize the possibility that I might be wrong about that, but it might not be objectively possible for me to have that belief and be wrong, have that belief formed in the way it actually was and be wrong. And so you might think the same thing about some of these religious claims, that it's impossible for me, it's impossible objectively for me to have formed that belief in the way that I did and be wrong. But the kind of, that's not the kind of, that's not what I mean by certainty when I deny certainty, right? I'm saying from my subjective point of view, I have to recognize this possibility of error.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spend a lot of time with early modern philosophy, and I've got this like enlightenment subjective individualism going on. and this is a kind of place where I'm not always going to get along with the Thomists, right?
Yeah.
But that's how I'm thinking of it.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Excellent. So I think I might have asked you a similar question last time, but I think it's always worth giving recommendations. So if anybody out there is wanting to read some good works from like formidable theistic philosophy that you would say are really rigorous, do you have any recommendations?
So I think I did recommend two books last time. Mm-hmm. Eleanor Stump's Wandering in Darkness and Sam Leben's The Principles of Judaism, I think were my previous recommendations.
Yeah.
Those are books I've been thinking about a lot. They're really good books.
Okay. Yeah.
Theistic philosophy. I mean, I recommend classics all the time. So I think people really should read Leibniz's Theodicy, but it requires some historical background. Okay. I don't remember if I mentioned this one last time. The Rasmussen and Proust Necessary Existence book is really good.
Okay.
If you're kind of up on the a bit of the more technical stuff in analytic metaphysics and modal logic and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not super technical, but has some technical bits. That's a really outstanding book that is relatively recent.
Speaking of then reading like some formidable stuff here, I know that you have essentially extensively studied some of the best defenders of atheism, like Mackey and Sobel and Oppie. Obviously you wrote a book with Oppie. But could you maybe explain why you chose to study those individuals and maybe how your thinking has changed as a result of engaging with those?
Yeah. So it's my whole trajectory in philosophy of religion started kind of by accident, just as an autobiographical matter.
Yeah.
So I had a blog going way the heck back to like 2003, like before before I even did my undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And I was in during my PhD, I was occasionally writing some philosophy of religion type stuff on there, but I wasn't seriously studying or working in philosophy of religion, because mm-hmm. I'm a scholar of the history of early modern philosophy. And there was an atheist blogger at the time whose name I'm afraid I have forgotten. I could probably find him in my blog archive, who had been blogging through a book by Richard Swinburne, and who challenged me to go through in a similar manner a book by Dawkins.
Okay, interesting.
And I surveyed my colleagues in my PhD program, the other students who were almost all atheists, and they agreed that they would be offended to have Dawkins taken as their representative. So I started kind of taking recommendations for like what's a better book if you were going to do this thing, and that's when I came across Sobel's Logic and Theism. And so I was started blogging kind of chapter by chapter, and partway through I got invited to join the Prosblogion, which was a big philosophy of religion blog at the time. Yeah. There's an attempted reboot going on now. But it was moribund for a while. And so then I was writing on there, and actually it was Sobel's chapter on omnipotence that started my publication career in philosophy of religion, That is, I had written some stuff about the puzzles for Omnipotence there. I got invited to write the Omnipotence article for the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy as a result of that blog post.
Oh, wow, nice.
But more importantly, Alexander Proust raised an objection to the analysis that I proposed. I suggested a fix for his objection, and he emailed me and said, I think your modified theory is correct. Do you want to write a paper together?
Nice.
And so that was, it was this kind of thing that, that actually got me started, in actually doing professional publications in philosophy of religion, rather than just being kind of an early modernist who cares about that stuff.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty crazy. I bet that felt pretty good.
Yeah. It was, cause like I said, I'd kind of just started writing my dissertation on an unrelated topic.
Uh-huh.
And certainly Proust was someone whose work I knew and admired.
Yeah.
And, so that was a surprising, turn of events.
Yeah.
And that in a lot of ways, almost everything I've written in philosophy of religion builds on that paper that I wrote with Proust.
Oh, nice.
So it really is, about the analysis of omnipotence. So that really is in a big way what got me started.
Oh, that's great. And that, that paper is available for free on, like, do you have it posted?
You can find an open access version on my website, writings.kennypierce.net.
Very cool. Okay. Yeah. So if anyone's interested to see the thing that started it all, right?
Yeah. Understanding Omnipotence is the title.
Very cool. Was the person who wrote the blog that challenged you originally, the atheist, our unnamed friend here, do you know which Swinburne book he was going through?
I don't remember. It might have been The Existence of God.
I was going to, that was my thought, that perhaps it would have been that one. And that book seems to be one that is greatly revered. And has, I guess you could say it's like taken as a book that sort of set the tone for analytic Christian philosophy. Would you agree with that? That's one of the books that...
It's one of the books, that has had that effect.
Yeah. And maybe on the other side, I mean, you talked about Sobel, which I think the logic and theism is a excellent resource on the other side, but Mackey's book, The Miracle of Theism, is probably also considered one of the foundational texts for analytic atheistic philosophy.
And you
talked a little bit about Sobel, but what do you think about Mackey's book, and why do you think that it is also kind of one of those like substantial, like necessary books on the atheistic side?
Yeah, well, I mean, the kind of standard story about analytic philosophy of religion, which of course, with my historian's hat on, I'm always saying, well, things are always more complicated than these little stories, right? Mm-hmm. But the standard story is that analytic philosophy of religion starts with the planting of Mackey debate, right, with Mackey's paper, Evil and Omnipotence, and planting his response is really often regarded as the beginning of analytic philosophy of religion, which in a way isn't quite fair. It's not like there was nothing before that, but it is, it has that level of importance.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, I see all these people as, they're very much at home in that, mid to late 20th century analytic philosophy milieu. They tend to be very deflationary about a lot of things, where this deflationism is no longer a widely held view, and it seems like we can't necessarily make sense of everything within that.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going on with really with Plantinga, Swinburne, and Mackey is a lot of just showing how philosophy of religion can be a serious and intellectually rigorous topic, even within the constraints of analytic philosophy as it was understood at that time. Which was something that, well, still today, it's much better today than it once was, but still today, there certainly are philosophers who think that philosophy of religion isn't really serious or something compared to other more important branches of philosophy. And so there are fewer of those people than there used to be. And these sorts of debates that were conducted, you know, according to the highest standards of rigor as analytic philosophers understood it at that time, and kind of using the tools that were accepted in analytic philosophy at that time, just had this really important effect in saying, hey, this is an important and intellectually serious topic that we can be discussing and debating. And even though Mackey thought that he thought, at least at first, that he had this really powerful knockdown argument in the original Evil and Omnipotence paper, you know, he was thinking, oh, there's this like line in Hume, referring to Epicurus about, you know, Epicurus's old query is yet unanswered. Is God unwilling to prevent evil or unable? Right. He's thinking that there's some serious philosophical work to be done in making that objection rigorous and precise. And that's the work he's doing in that paper, and it's the work Plantinga is responding to. And then we have Mackey developing this in a kind of kind of mid-20th century analytic, kind of broadly neo-Humean sort of way, in that book Logic and Theism, or in the book The Miracle of Theism. And so in that sense, it kind of it plays this important historical role in seeing what those philosophy of religion debates might look like and why they might be important in kind of in this context of analytic philosophy.
Yeah. Now, obviously Mackey and Swinburne come to very different conclusions, but they seem to agree on a lot as well. Like, would you agree that they both are broadly empiricists in their commitments, and I think they both use things like Bayes' theorem, and they see theism as broadly like a metaphysical hypothesis. Like, do you think, well, first, is that accurate? And then do you agree with that general methodology when it comes to evaluating the existence of God?
Yeah, so I think that I think Swinburne and Mackey are very similar methodologically, which can make for productive debate. I think that they're also very similar in the kinds of conceptual and metaphysical tools that they think are kind of acceptable to appeal to. And these kind of epistemological questions, the broadly Bayesian approach. That would be pretty different, I think, from my own approach. There's a kind of foundationalist tendency there that I think is attractive, but unfortunately unworkable. To kind of have a conception of what our basic evidence is and how we're going to build all our beliefs up from some kind of basic evidence in this broadly Bayesian sort of way. I'm also, I think there are some clear cases where the Bayesian approach correctly models human reasoning at its best, and that that can be useful then to make use of it, not only for artificial intelligence and whatnot, but also for trying to make our reasoning more rigorous in those kinds of cases. I'm not persuaded that it's correct as a general or universal epistemic framework, or even that it's getting the fundamental epistemic norms right, as opposed to just figuring out how to model those norms mathematically. Some of the norms for some kinds of cases. And something that people, something that's often missed in this debate is there are three things we need to keep straight. Bayes' theorem, which is a theorem of the mathematics of probability and is just true.
Yeah.
Then there's the Bayesian interpretation of probabilities, which you can be a pluralist about probabilities and thinking that there's more than one kind of probability, right? But it does seem like the Bayesian interpretation of probability is one legitimate notion. This notion says that we can view kind of degrees of confidence in, or degrees of subjective certainty, they sometimes say, that we can model that in a with probability theory. I think there are limits to that enterprise because of the notorious problem that we humans are not logically omniscient. And that means that we need to assign like probabilities less than one to things that are logically necessary, like formally provable, like Goldbach's conjecture or something.
Right.
And there is kind of no way that I'm aware of dealing with that correctly in the Bayesian math, which is one of the reasons that I think we have to restrict the application or else regard it as an idealization that only applies to beings that are logically omniscient. So that's the Bayesian interpretation of probabilities. The third thing is what's usually called Bayesian epistemology. And this is the view that Bayes' theorem is provides the correct rule for updating your degrees of subjective certainty over time. And the reason this has to be kept separate from the other two, and people sometimes don't do this, is that the mathematics of probability does not say anything about how your assignment of probabilities should change over time. It just tells you whether your assignment of probabilities at one time is coherent. Right, so it's a constraint on at one time, what set of probabilities can you assign to things without being subject to a Dutch book or making some demonstrably irrational bets. And so this, and there is another well-developed approach called Jeffrey conditionalization. This isn't really my specialization to know how all of these things work. But again, the claim that Bayes' theorem provides a rule for updating credences in light of new evidence is a substantive claim in epistemology and not a mathematical theorem. Okay, and then, so that's the issues I have with Bayesianism, that I guess I think it's kind of a good idealized model for certain restricted circumstances. Besides the logical omniscience problem, the biggest problem with trying to actually use it philosophically in a debate is that these are degrees of subjective certainty. So we have to assign numbers to our priors. And we humans either don't have, or at least are not aware of, perfectly precise credences that are real numbers. Probably, I mean, if you want to do it as a way of modeling behavior, like what kinds of bets do you accept or reject, probably we should model our behavior as having like priors or having credences that fluctuate within some range, right? In a way that's probably irrational and not really explained by Bayes' theorem, but they're such small fluctuations that we don't notice we're doing it or something like that. But the problem is when you do some kind of giant cumulative case argument like Swinburne's, we can get different results by making very small adjustments in the initial probabilities. And so the and so it's just hard to see how that is, how those like precise probabilities in a cumulative case argument are doing real work. I'm much less skeptical about like much less skeptical about the skeptical theism literature. In the skeptical theism literature, there's a lot of debates about like how much should this move your credence. Where they're not trying to say, oh, my credence started exactly here and then I encountered this evidence and then I adjusted it like this and see it's, but Swinburne gives some number at the end. It's like 0.97 or something that God exists, right? That's effectively a made up number because you can engineer the credences however you want for the beginning. And it gives this illusion of precision. But when you're talking about, hey, if you're, if you think that disbelief is this range, like less than 0.3 and belief is greater than 0.7 and you start out anywhere in this broad range, then this is going to move you like from agnosticism into belief or into non-belief. Like those things I think are kind of interesting, and the Bayesian model maybe actually helps us think more clearly in those sorts of cases.
I find, well, obviously, because I'm a mathematician, I obviously find Bayesianism quite interesting, both philosophically and mathematically. But now, remind me, you more identify as a classical theist, is that right?
I use that term, yeah. People, like a lot of philosophical terms, people use them in different ways.
Right.
I don't endorse, some people take the defining feature of classical theism to be the like ultra strong divine simplicity, which I find attractive but don't understand.
Gotcha.
yeah.
Well, I bring that up because it seems like many Thomists or and classical theists reject the idea that we should construe God as like a metaphysical hypothesis, and perhaps think that what we need to do to justify God's existence is to appeal to like a metaphysical demonstration, you know, along the lines of what Aquinas does. But, well, what are your thoughts on that? Is that right? Or, yeah. And is that kind of how you think? Or
I'm more sympathetic to, my approach is closer to the Thomist one than to the Swinburne one, I guess, if we're right. Arranging things on a spectrum between them.
Sure.
'Cause I like the contingency argument.
Yep.
I do see this as, I guess I do see, if what they mean is that God is like, you know, the core feature, the core bit of a metaphysical framework, the ultimate root of a metaphysical framework, which is different than being some other kind of hypothesis, I guess I'm agreed with the Thomists on that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm skeptical about demonstration, and I think the reason is that I just don't accept, maybe I don't accept their notion of self-evidence at all, or at least I don't think the things are self-evident that they take to be self-evident. I think a lot of Thomists, I think actually Aquinas has interesting things to say about faith and certainty, and a lot of Thomists are kind of going a bit too far with the certainty thing compared to Aquinas himself. When he argues that sacred doctrine is a science at the beginning of Summa Theologiae, he says one of the objections he considers is that it can't be a science because it begins from principles that are not self-evident since they're not accepted by everyone. And he accepts that claim and has this whole argument for why that doesn't prevent it from being a science. And the things he says about that are really interesting. Now there are more complicated distinctions to be drawn in the interpretation of Aquinas, because when we're in medieval philosophy, distinctions are what we do all day. So I don't want to oversimplify here, but I guess what I want to say is I don't think the distinction is so sharp between these two approaches. Maybe some people have something really specific that they mean by hypothesis. But what I think is that I endorse a metaphysical framework that has God as the kind of ultimate root of all reality. And there are kind of other bits of the framework that seem to require that about grounding and explanation and whatnot. But at the end of the day, there are alternative frameworks. And when you look at why I endorse this one and not one of the other ones, we're talking about basically theory choice considerations.
Right.
Well, I mean, I really like so what I'm calling theory choice is closely related to worldview comparison ideas. Yeah. And I do really like Graham Oppy's discussion of that in his book, Arguing About Gods.
Okay.
But you would also want to get into the philosophy of science literature on this, about how theory choice works in the sciences.
Okay.
I don't have great book recommendations off the top of my head for that area.
Is theory choice the word that, or the phrase that they would use? Like, is that something someone could look up and they would find literature on it just by looking up theory choice?
Yeah, or theoretical virtues is a common phrase. So generally, you compare theories for their theoretical virtues.
Yeah.
And the question of the role these theoretical virtues play in the philosophy of science is a really big thing.
Yeah.
And the and there are there's kind of a lot of literature on things like aesthetic virtues and why do scientists prefer more elegant theories?
Right.
And I'll recommend to you, especially because you're a math person, two excellent books by Penelope Matty.
Okay.
Yeah. Naturalism in Mathematics and Defending the Axioms.
Yeah. You know what? I think I might have that second one
already. Yes.
And that was by Penelope...
Matty.
Penelope Matty.
Yeah. And... she's her book Naturalism in Mathematics, which she doesn't, I think she's revised her view some, so Defending the Axioms is a much more recent book, but Naturalism in Mathematics is about, she has this idea that as physics is our most well-developed science of concrete objects, mathematics is our most well-developed science of abstract objects.
Yeah.
And it turns out, and so we should trust their deliverances just the same.
Yeah.
It turns out that they follow different principles. And in particular, according to her, physics follows a principle of parsimony, where we want to posit less stuff. And mathematics follows a principle of plenitude, where kind of the more mathematical objects you can get, the better.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about it is she's thinking that, like in set theory, that axiom choice for set theory is something like theory choice in the sciences.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And we prefer axioms that are more generative.
Sure.
That we want to, you know, she is thinking about people who work on constructing large cardinals and things like this.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's another kind of application of this theory choice stuff in a surprising place.
That's awesome. I have to check that out for sure. Would you say there's some value in like maybe a pluralistic approach? You know, I don't know if they're like, necessarily, I'm not saying they're all compatible, but you know, like theory choice, but also Bayesian epistemology, you know, kind of taking a multiple pronged approach.
Yeah, I think that it very much depends on the particular context and the framework of background assumptions and so forth.
Yeah.
So when I'm thinking about theory choice or worldview comparison, this tends to be about kind of very broad frameworks, right? That we think about things this way.
Yeah.
And where the Bayesian stuff works better for modeling is where we kind of are holding a lot of the framework fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those cases, where you're holding a lot of the framework fixed rather than comparing two very different frameworks, it'll be easier to kind of assign some probabilities and conditional probabilities and figure out what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you also won't run into problems like, talk about the math stuff, a kind of irritation of mine in a lot of philosophy of religion literature, including about fine tuning and so forth, is that when they get beyond the physics fine tuning and they're like into talking about now consider the whole space of metaphysically possible worlds,
mm-hmm.
And what a small proportion of them have life in them, or what's the probability, or what, there's probably a proper class of possible worlds, but naively, for every cardinal number k, possibly there are k concrete objects.
Sure.
So there's a proper class of okay, if you don't buy that, if you think there's some reason why very large cardinals couldn't be the cardinality of the set of concrete objects, still, probably it's larger, the set of possible worlds, if there is one, is larger than any measurable set.
Sure.
So attempts to assign probabilities and do this Bayesian thing when you don't have a framework of assumptions to hold fixed.
Right.
May not make sense.
Yeah.
There may be these mathematical anomalies that prevent us from modeling it in that way.
Mm.
But it also may be that quite apart from the technical problems about the math, mm-hmm. that's not the right way to think about it.
Yeah.
But when you've got a framework and you're holding a lot of stuff fixed, then I think you can kind of usefully use the Bayesian approach.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I'm very interested in epistemology, but I don't know if I could say, you know, I'm definitely a Bayesian or I'm definitely this or that, you know. It kind of goes back to the uncertainty, you know, if I'm uncertain about the true nature of reality, I'm also uncertain about, you know, like what's the best way to think about it in terms of the epistemology, you know. So they're also all very difficult questions. So
those kind of meta uncertainties are also something Bayesianism struggles to model.
You had mentioned some, you know, your blog that you were working on in the past, and I think in one of them, do you remember writing a post titled Dawkins and the Philosophers?
Yeah, I think that was kind of a long time ago.
So in that, you wrote, philosophy of religion today is actually dominated by Christians and it is suffering as a result. I would love to see more philosophically sophisticated atheists expend the effort to defend their viewpoint. So could you kind of, I mean, you've kind of talked a little bit about this already, but maybe you could elaborate on why you'd want that and how do you think that would benefit the discipline?
Let me say, if I was writing that today, that might have been 12 or 15 years ago, that blog post. It's old.
Yeah.
If I was writing that today, I would have put a lot of emphasis on other religious perspectives as well.
Okay.
As the atheistic one. Because the fact that it's been framed as a debate primarily between Christians and atheists,
right,
is also a serious limitation.
Sure.
And then that, like, fewer of the atheists go into philosophy of religion. So
yeah,
if you're looking at metaphysics, the large majority of people working in metaphysics or philosophy of science or epistemology, the large majority of those are atheists.
Hmm.
But it's rare for them to kind of take the time and effort to write something that's primarily about philosophy of religion. And maybe this isn't so surprising, because if you are a theist, or if you're somehow religious or whatever, there's a lot more interesting questions in philosophy of religion.
Right.
Right. If you're comfortable in your atheism, right, and you're not in doubt about your atheism,
mm-hmm.
Then maybe there aren't a lot of questions that will interest you in philosophy of religion. Maybe you might be motivated to take the time to spell out why you're comfortable and secure in endorsing atheism. But so that seems like part of what's going on. You know, some people think the philosophers of religion are the experts and they're overwhelmingly Christian theists. So we have some kind of argument from expertise here. Mm-hmm. I'm much more worried about the selection bias thing, especially given that there are so many, like, adjacent, highly relevant areas of expertise that are overwhelmingly atheist, right?
Right.
So there's something going on there. But what I think philosophy is just all about is encountering alternative views of the world and encountering critiques of your own views.
Yeah.
And thinking through them carefully and revising your beliefs in light of them.
Yeah.
And we philosophers all work very hard at coming up with the best arguments against our own views.
Yeah.
But people who are outside that view may be better equipped to do that.
Sure.
And so I just think kind of more of this discussion, a broader range of people coming into philosophy of religion would make even we Christian philosophers will do better work if we have more engagement with them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I just, let me keep mentioning this book, The Principles of Judaism by Sam Leibniz.
Yeah, go for it.
He's pulling these ideas out of like 17th century Hasidic rabbis whose works haven't been translated. Uh-huh. And he's applying them in, like, highly rigorous analytic philosophy, and showing that they have these fascinating ideas that totally challenge ways that theistic philosophers have looked at things.
Uh-huh.
And none of the rest of us even can read that because we don't know the languages. Those of us who, you know, most of us Christian analytic philosophers. And so I just think, you know, there was all this time where that stuff wasn't valued and people would have thought it was too esoteric or something. And maybe some people still think that today, but mm-hmm. people who think that way are wrong. Mm. This kind of stuff that people just coming from a different tradition that has different ideas in it can bring into the conversation is so overwhelmingly valuable. And encountering those different views is just what philosophy is really all about.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, philosophers working hard to come up with the best challenges against their views. What would you say, what arguments would you say from the atheistic side would you find most challenging?
The problem of divine freedom. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking especially, I'm always recommending this book by William Rowe, Can God Be Free? It's nearly 20 years old now, but it's still such a fantastic book. And it's short uh-huh. and it's historically informed, which I always like. Uh-huh. And it's accessible for beginners. That might be my vote for most underappreciated philosophy of religion for beginners book.
Okay.
That would be, that actually for the absolute, for the beginner, that might be the atheistic book I would most recommend.
Okay.
Sobel is a little more advanced.
Yeah, that's true.
and so that, the reason that argument I think is so important is just that it is challenging in a deep way whether the concept of God is coherent.
Mm-hmm.
So the argument from evil and the hiddenness argument are both very serious challenges because the world doesn't look like we would expect it to look under theism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should all just admit that. And then but the skeptical theist move is saying is like, yeah, but we shouldn't really trust our expectations because we're not God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has to be part of any response to that. And I think that's a legitimate move. Okay. But unlike some skeptical theists, I think we say, no, if we understand the claim that there is a God
mm-hmm.
at all,
yeah,
then we can kind of say a bit about what we would expect the world to look like if that was true.
Right.
And it's not this.
Yeah.
So those are serious challenges.
Yeah.
But they're downstream from this problem of divine freedom.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because that's a challenge about whether we can make sense of the notion of God at all. And the problem is particularly about whether we can make sense of the notion of a being who's necessarily morally perfect.
Mm, okay.
Because the problem is that we might think that a being who can't do otherwise is not a moral agent at all. Can't be morally praiseworthy for doing right because that being can't do otherwise.
Right, right, right.
And so the fact that God is supposed to be necessarily morally perfect seems to conflict with divine freedom.
Mm.
But you can't just give up divine freedom if you think freedom is required for moral attribution.
Mm.
I'm not sure responsibility is the right word to apply to God. But if someone has to do something freely in order to be praiseworthy for it.
I see.
And
yeah.
and Rowe emphasizes that this isn't just about some abstract metaphysics, because praising God is like a core element of religious practice across a wide variety of traditions.
Yeah.
And thanking God. And so if God has to be free in order to be praised or thanked, but can't be free and at the same time morally perfect, then we've got not just a kind of conflict with what's empirically observed, but a problem right at the heart of the concept of God. And a good deal of my current work engages in some way or in some degree with that puzzle.
Okay. So those are some of the things you find most challenging. Would you say that there are any arguments from the atheist side that have definitively failed and should just be retired?
well,
It depends on it depends on what you yeah, it depends on what you mean, I guess, by because I hesitate to be definitive because maybe somebody will come up with a new version.
Are there any that you like see that atheists tend to use a lot where you're like, yeah, you should just sort of like not use that?
Yeah, so there are some that I'm there are some that I'm in the same way that I say about the moral argument for God. You know, what I'm saying is it's not that you can't kind of use considerations in that area to motivate belief in God. But it's that you're presenting this as a very simple argument that just like instantly destroys atheism, and that's completely wrong. I would say the same thing about the logical problem of evil, that if I don't think Plantinga has proved that evil and God are compatible, but I think he's shown that no strategy along the lines of Mackey's can show that they're incompatible. And more generally, I think there's not much hope for, I don't think atheists should have much hope of a kind of convincing proof of logical incompatibility between the existence of God and any evil at all.
I see.
And so I think it would be much more productive to focus on particularly difficult varieties of evil, on the magnitude of evil, on evidential considerations, rather than trying to make that simplistic argument. There also, of course, are just talking points about theism being unscientific or something like that, that kind of just there isn't much argument behind that. But there is still a possibility of kind of having a discussion about which view better accords with science as we know it today, right? Yeah, so I would say those are examples of cases where the idea that there's just some really straightforward refutation is at least somewhat widespread in popular atheist circles and is badly mistaken.
Kind of with the last one you mentioned, would you, I imagine you'd include in that, you know, not very many sophisticated atheists would say this, but you'd still see it a lot, you know, especially in like social media and stuff where some atheists will just be like, well, there's just zero evidence for God. You know, like
Oh
literally
yeah, I forgot
none.
that one. And those people, what I can't believe is the people who double down on that, right? Where you're like, do you mean that the evidence is negligible or that like all the evidence is weak or that it's undercut by other considerations on further reflection? And they're like, no. I mean, there's no evidence. That's you know, you start explaining, well, in philosophy, we understand evidence in this really broad sense. And there's like, no, I mean, there's no evidence.
Do you
And that's not true of anything, right? There's any proposition has some evidence in its favor. It's just a matter of whether the evidence is any good and whether it's decisively outweighed by opposing considerations.
Do you think a lot of those people just are misunderstanding what, yeah, kind of like what you were saying, what evidence is? Like they're not really using it in a very precise way, perhaps, or do you think they have something very specific in mind?
I have difficulty understanding them, and I'm afraid that some people have just like absorbed a talking point and just keep repeating it. And it may not be much more than a talking point. I think there's other people who think something like the evidence of the sort that you could present in a science journal. Right. Now, they've got to be thinking something that narrow. So there is, in fact, evidence for the existence of God that is of the same sort as the kind of evidence that gets admitted in courtrooms. For instance, people who purport to be eyewitness testimony, who purport to be eyewitnesses who could give testimony. there, so it's of the same general sort, and so then you've got to say, well, it's not any good, or it's undercut somehow, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there probably are some people who have a super narrow notion of testimony.
Sure.
That is kind of based on the natural sciences. Even that, it's not clear that it's true that there's literally none.
Yeah.
Like, there's some ambiguous evidence. I don't like these studies myself, but we're not talking about if there's good evidence. We're talking about if there's any evidence.
Right.
There's some kind of ambiguous studies about the impact of prayer on healing from diseases, and like some analyses suggest that people have a marginally better chance of recovery if they're prayed for.
Yeah.
And right, so like that's it. So like those studies are mixed.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you can point to things like that you're like, actually, it's really weak evidence.
Yeah.
But it is the kind of evidence that's submitted in the sciences, and it exists. And so why are you not content with saying that the quality of evidence is very poor, or that the evidence is decisively weighted to the opposite side?
Yeah.
Or that the kind of best evidence for theism is seriously undercut by other considerations. But like when given the opportunity to walk back to one of those positions that are plenty strong enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Why won't people do that? And I think it's just something about the adversarial, competitive desire to like win an argument and knock the opposing side down.
Yeah.
That leads you to not want to cede an inch. And
right.
So I guess part of it, the more collaborative approach that I try to take and that I want to take in philosophy.
Yeah.
Is always to try to find points of agreement.
Yeah, that's good.
Rather than to be in that don't want to give an inch place.
Right. Yeah, I think that's admirable. And I really appreciate that about you, for instance, because I think it happens on both sides. You know, there's like a phobia of like admitting that, you know, either there is evidence for something that you disagree with, or maybe on the Christian side that there is evidence against, you know, right. And the idea of having to admit that they think like they're losing in some way if they admit that there's anything that counts against their belief. I think it's a very unhelpful position to be in. And I think a lot of, apologists, the thing that irritates me about, well, again, it's on both sides, so I don't want to just pick on the one side, but apologists from either side tend to, since we've been talking about kind of retiring arguments, you know, I feel like on either side, neither one wants to give up any of the arguments, you know, so if it's something that supports their view, then they condone it, you know, or they support it, you know, like here's an argument that supports my view. So I will support it, even if it's a bad argument, you know, whereas I think philosophers tend to be more honest, you know, like, yeah, that's just not a good argument, you know, even though I agree with the conclusion of the argument, it's not a good one.
And this is really high on my list of like, what do I hope students get if they take a philosophy class?
Yeah.
Is the ability to say an argument is good or bad, or perhaps use technical terms like valid, invalid, sound, unsound, or whatever. Right. But to say an argument is good or bad and mean something other than I agree or disagree with the conclusion.
Right.
But to be able to actually evaluate an argument and not just feel one way or another about its conclusion.
Exactly.
And that's what we do all day.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you say there's anything on the theistic side that should be retired as far as, I mean, maybe you've kind of hinted at maybe the moral argument is not such a great one to use, but are there any other ones that you can think like, yeah, we shouldn't be really using that?
The moral argument is definitely top of my list. But I guess I have kind of the same perspective for both, which is this like the real problem is treating a simplistic argument as some kind of knockdown.
Yeah.
When in fact, all of these arguments raise much more complicated considerations.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say the moral argument is one. I'm pretty skeptical about any kind of arguments that are based on contemporary physics. The fine tuning argument, I would not say is in the should be retired category. Like, there's interesting issues going on there.
Sure.
Arguments from the finite age of the universe. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think that, that we should retire arguments for finite age of the universe from paradoxes of infinity.
okay.
Because in the first place, the mathematicians have that figured out now.
Yeah.
And in the second place, the like way to look at whether the universe is finite or infinite in age is to do physical cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the standard Big Bang model does have finite age, but not all the models that are currently going concerns do. And given that physicists are doing mathematically rigorous work on this, coming at them with Hilbert's hotel is a joke.
Sure.
Right. Like, yeah. they know what they're about. We should listen to them.
Yeah.
They have coherent models that don't have finite age.
Yeah.
And the considerations that should lead us to determine whether the universe is infinite or finite in age are physical considerations.
Thank you for listening. The music you're hearing is by Chicago-based band Casserole and used with permission. If you appreciate the content and the tone of what Relay Theology has to offer, you can show that appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. You can support us directly by making a small, recurring donation to our Patreon. Comments, questions, criticisms, or requests can be sent in audio form to relaytheology@gmail.com. for possible inclusion in future episodes. We want to thank our patrons, Tyler Bimrose, Jason, Robin Willems, Ed Atkinson, Kim Buchkowski, Anthony Lawson, Jeff Rubinoff, and Brandon McCleary.